This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
On the other hand, you see government ministers slithering and sliding to avoid paying any tax at all. And you see the Prime Minister accepting gifts of football tickets. It's seedy. Where is the integrity in politics anymore?
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Hello and welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In a week, we took a deep dive into the issues surrounding the small boats crisis, and cold water was poured on Angela Rayner's local government reorganisation plans. I'm Simon Finley, the local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Dan Essen, who reports on the Borough and District Councils.
Hello.
And there's no Robert or Boddy or Nicky White this week, but we will be joined by senior editor Matt Ramsden. And our special guest today is the former soldier, businessman and parliamentary candidate Colonel Tim Collins, who rose to prominence in 2003 when he gave a rousing eve of battle speech to his men ahead of the invasion of Iraq. Dan, what have you been looking at?
Councils are only just waking up from their summer siestas, so not too much going on that front. So instead, I wrote a longer form piece about the history of small boats and illegal immigration as a political issue and the effect it's had on Kent.
Yeah, it's a well-trodden issue. What did you find anything new?
Well, nothing new in and of itself. Obviously, none of this will be a huge news flash to keen listeners of this podcast or readers of the news in general. But I was surprised when I looked at the data to find out basically just how much of a recent phenomenon small boats in particular are. And obviously, we've mentioned before that small boats are, you've mentioned, that small boats arose as a result of other methods becoming untenable. But when I looked at it, I found in 2016, only about 100 people made it to the UK via small boats. In 2018, it was almost 600. By 2019, that had reached 1,800 people. But now in the past 13 months, 50,000 people arrived on small boats. So obviously, you know, that's still a small proportion of overall immigration, but the vast increase is basically a phenomenon in the past 5 years or so. And in that time, it's basically become the central issue of British politics, much to the chagrin of some and the delight of others. Mm.
Do you think the politics of the issue have changed much in that time?
Definitely. I mean, so obviously I grew up in Dover, of all places, so it was something that was discussed very regularly. And yeah, there was the odd protests around it and like when I was a teenager. But locally and nationally, it's now the defining political issue in a way that it wasn't even only, you know, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Hence, yeah, I wasn't very surprised when Reform came second there in the general election last year and when they took all seven seats for the county council for Dover earlier this year. But as I argue in the piece, this is basically because both legal and illegal immigration have increased despite every government for 15 years promising to reduce it. And in that time, the British economy has basically become structurally dependent on high immigration, making it even harder to solve. Hence, we're now at a point where Labour and the Tories compete to seem more credibly anti-immigration, while Nigel Farage and Reform are clearly the beneficiaries of the mainstream's failure. So it's become a cipher for pretty much everything the public dislike about the state. And Kent is both on the literal and symbolic front line of that issue. What have you been up to at County Hall this week, Simon?
Well, which, as the name suggests, represents England's county councils, issued a very interesting statement in the past couple of days, which could throw some cold water over the planned local government reorganisation, which was launched last December by the Deputy Prime Minister and soon-to-be resident of Hove, Angela Rayner. It turns out that the project, which will effectively see all 14 elected councils in Kent be abolished, and that will happen elsewhere in England as well, they'll abolish themselves and be replaced by a smaller number of much larger unitary authorities. And this new finding seems to suggest that they may not have the savings that the government was hoping for. Labour hopes that a new slimmed down system of local government will be cheaper, more efficient, and empower local decision making to be done more quickly.
How so? How'd they work out that it would save money?
Well, Angela Rayner's plans were based in significant part by work commissioned by the County Council's network and delivered by PricewaterhouseCoopers, who are experts in providing professional services. That pretty massive piece of work was undertaken in 2020. So the local government reorganisation was based on data compiled in 2020. And her department had understandably taken from this that 2.9 billion could be saved over 5 years, which is a healthy saving for a government stuck for money.
And obviously there's a bit of a but coming, isn't there?
Indeed, you're correct. There is a but coming. When the CCN asked PricewaterhouseCoopers to revisit and update the 2020 work in March of this year, the picture was rather different. Bearing in mind that if all counties like Kent need to have two, three, or maybe four new unitary authorities, it means there could be dozens of new unitary authorities across the county. We don't know yet what that number will be. However, the new updated version of the 2020 report is now saying that those £2.9 billion savings can only be achieved if all 21 counties with a two-tier system, like Kent, are replaced with a single unitary authority. And then when the County Councils Network that undertook a separate analysis, it discovered that £1.8 billion could still be saved, but only if the government created 29 unitary authorities with populations of more than 500,000. This is probably insufficient to cater for the regions needing to be covered by the new authorities. So CCN said that if 58 new authorities were created, the number which is closer to the number which will actually be needed, it could end up costing the government £850 million and deliver no long-term savings. So bearing in mind that the new Reform UK leader, KCC, Lyndon Kim-Caron, recently suggested that Kent could best be served by creating one authority in Kent, she was probably closer to the mark of what the new analysis seemed to indicate. So to Lyndon Kim-Caron's credit, she has said that more than once that she believes that the numbers just don't add up. Whether her suggestions makes it into Kent's package of proposals to go before the local government minister, Jim McMahon, in November, remains to be seen.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
22 years ago, Colonel Tim Collins gave a rousing eve of battle speech to soldiers of the Royal Irish Regiment during the war to liberate Saddam Hussein's Iraq. That day, he reminded them of their duties. They must be magnanimous in victory, to treat the people with respect and allow the enemy dignity in death. The speech would probably have gone unrecorded, but for the contemporaneous shorthand note of a journalist present that day. It made headlines all over the world and earned Colonel Collins praise, the speech becoming an example of an army officer instructing his troops to conduct themselves properly in the theatre of war. If you are ferocious in battle, remember to be magnanimous in victory, he said. Since leaving the British military, he has become a well-known media commentator and businessman, even dipping his toe into the world of politics. Tim Collins joins us today. Hello, Tim.
Hi.
When you made that speech, did you have any idea it would have the effect it did and still be referenced nearly a quarter of a century later?
No, it was purely for my soldiers, and it just happened that it was published by a journalist, as you said, who'd taken it down shorthand, but it was for no one else except my soldiers.
Yeah. I mean, did you write it? Did you rehearse it?
No. I mean, the thing is that being the modern world, many theories, including Tony Blair, wrote it, utter nonsense. It was basically me speaking to my soldiers about something which was going to be important to them and me.
How much did your upbringing in Northern Ireland during the Troubles influence your ambitions as a soldier?
I guess you'd have seen the army all around, but I think that I wanted to be a soldier before that. My uncle had been in the army and been in served in the Far East in the Second World War, and I lived across the road from a Territorial Army barracks and often would go over and play over there, and I think that was more of an influence.
But you would have seen a lot of the sectarian violence in the early part of the Troubles.
Well, to a certain extent, yes and no, and that every now and again something would touch you. I went to school in the centre of town, but by and large, much of the actual violence was confined to areas of Belfast. There'd be areas that would be relatively untouched until the IRA Sinn Féin brought the bombing campaign actually in to destroy the economy, and that's when you start to see shops being blown up and people being murdered openly.
You live in Canterbury. And Kent has a long history of being a base for the armed forces. And today we live in a pretty dangerous and uncertain world. Do you believe we have the military personnel to defend ourselves?
As in the armed forces generally? I mean, simply no. We don't. And Kent was once a place that hosted the military, but increasingly there's very little left in Kent. And with the intention to move the engineers out of Maidstone, there'll be hardly anything except some territorial army units. Overall, in terms of the armed forces, now we're woefully unready for future conflict. It's coming, but there's no votes in defence, and I don't think there's any incentive for government to spend money on defence.
Talking earlier, that very famous speech you gave was on the eve of the joint Western invasion of Iraq. I want to ask you, with everything that's happened since, and especially the extent to which many argue the Western intervention in Iraq destabilised the Middle East as a whole, do you still think that was a war worth fighting?
Well, in as much as, there's sort of two different views on that. We certainly destabilised the Middle East in terms of the rise of the jihadi movements, but I think that's probably been down to the way in which we conducted as opposed to anything else. I go a long way to find being as done as ineptly as it was done by Paul Bremer and the other people who were involved in it. On the other hand, I worked in Iraq for many years after the coalition, working with the Iraqis and working alongside people who had been guests of Saddam Hussein in his prisons. And if you were one of them, then it was very worthwhile taking away the tyrant. So on one hand, removing the tyrant was a very good thing to do, but removing the tyrant without any plan what to put in its place, that was a big mistake. And of course, the thing that history will recognise, but at the moment in the Corbynite era that we live in, everything's moving too fast and there's far too many experts. But the reality is that the one thing that held Iraq together as a glue under Saddam Hussein and would have continued to hold Iraq together after Saddam Hussein was the Iraqi army. And the decision to disband the Iraqi army was the button which initiated the wars which we see today.
So obviously the war in Iraq is probably one of the most famous sort of military conflicts of the 21st century, especially in Britain, because it was the last, one of the last major wars we were involved in. But of course, Britain also, we were involved in the intervention in Afghanistan. And while we pulled out earlier than the Americans, we were there for a long time. We were helped send airstrikes to Libya in 2011 to overthrow the Gaddafi regime, which many point out essentially contributed to the modern European migrant crisis by destabilising Libya and creating a route through which people could get into Europe. Do you think the West has a proud record of military intervention in the 21st century? Because it seems a lot of people increasingly think we don't.
Well, it's military interventions. There's a difference between wars and interventions. And the interventions that came along were inspired by events that really were tumbling out of control, because a fragile order where much of the Middle East was dominated by dictators like Saddam Hussein, like Muammar Gaddafi, like Bashar al-Assad, they held their countries in a form of stability. And arguably, if you were part of their group, were a good place to live. But if you weren't, then they weren't such a good place to live. By removing those individuals, yes, the movement of people and the hostage crisis, that has come about with it. But the reality is that these people were ever going to last for a long time. The only dictator I can see lasting past the next few years really is Kim Jong-il in North Korea, because he's so well entrenched there. But when you look around the world by and large is run by strong men. President Erdogan has no intention of giving up power in Turkey. He said himself that democracy is a train which you can get on and off. Vladimir Putin is well entrenched in Russia. Xi Jinping is well entrenched in China. Alexander Lukashenko in Belarus has no intention of going anywhere, and that's why he can't deploy his army, because his army protects him and keeps him in power. And the ramshackle regime in Tehran, there's no prospect of it collapsing, in my view, for a long time to come. It's well entrenched, it's well protected. So these types of regime will continue. Would it be a good thing to remove him? Well, we need to look at the removal of Muammar Gaddafi and the removal of Bashar al-Assad and see the chaos that follows and ask yourself, are we ready to cope with that? Do we have a plan?
You mentioned that there are no votes in defence. Why have successive governments, in your view, allied the armed forces in this country to become so depleted?
Well, it's a good way of saving money. On one hand, the Conservatives were basically inept. The Labour government is generally hostile to the army. I mean, any good socialist doesn't like things like the British Army, because the British Army is rooted in communities and societies. It used to be, and the regimental system was how the army was raised for 1,000 years, was a real threat to socialism, because people were hard to control because their loyalty was to their camp badge. If you dismantle that, then you've more control. And control is the thing that they want more than anything else. And so the armed forces is not something which socialists see as something that is useful to them, because it stands independent and it's hard to manipulate, unlike the police. And the Conservatives, they were just simply inept. They were asleep at the wheel.
Previously, the Member of Parliament for Tunbridge Wells, and also a former soldier, Mike Martin, told us pretty openly he thinks Britain should get more on a war footing. And he thinks that within a decade, Britain will likely be involved in a major war, most likely with Russia. What do you rate of his prediction?
Well, I think that there is a strong possibility that there will be an imperfect peace in Ukraine. History has taught us, when we look at what Russia between wars, and particularly Russia's reaction to its defeat in 1905 in Port Arthur, it'll use the time to rebuild and rearm. And so that imperfect peace will be an opportunity for Russia to, having learned the lessons of Ukraine, get itself much better organized and learn the lessons of that conflict. The likelihood is that Western European nations will do nothing with that time. They will not spend the money. And in many respects, the Russians and the authoritarian regimes in Iran and in China are very good at manipulating our media and our social media in particular. And they will be working hard to encourage people to resist any rearmament and to resist anything of the sort. And the reality is that the people who are protesting most about that have most to lose, because if the Russians were to take over the United Kingdom with Chinese assistance, they might do it by military force, but they might do it with the assistance of fifth columnists, people who like their approach and regime better, and assist them in doing that. What would a regime like that look like? Well, the Russians have lived in London before, and we've lived amongst them, and the oligarchs and the school that my children went to in St. Lawrence, there's lots of Russian children went there. So we know what it looked like. Who needs to worry about that? Well, I think if you've got blue hair and you protest, or if you're gay, or if you're transsexual, you need to be worried, because they don't want you in their world anymore. People like me, a married man with five children, they're not even interested in us. They'll leave us alone.
Surely this is, the idea that a country like Russia has any chance of military involvement in Western Europe, or of meaningfully influencing British government, surely that sounds, on a level with sort of Cold War era paranoia. It's not even like there are political parties in Britain which get funding from Russia, like they did, for example, the Communist Party of Britain took a lot of money from the Soviet Union. Surely that's the stuff of dystopian fantasy. There's not actually any prospect of Russia controlling Britain through fifth columnists, like you say.
Oh, really? So, I'm mistaken. So the Russian money from the FSB that's funding Palestine Action, and the money and the significant presence in our country of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, who are funding pretty much every subversive group in the country, that's, I'm wrong, that's not happening. I'm glad to hear that.
I've certainly never seen any proof of that.
Well, there's evidence, there's huge proof of that. And I think the Home Secretary has also said that she can't disclose the nature of the funding of Palestine Action, but it's significant as a threat to national security. There's a clue.
Yeah. After you left the army with an enviable reputation and high profile, political parties were sort of falling over themselves to get you on board, principally the Conservatives and the Ulster Unionists. This is back in the early 2000s. Why did you decide at that point not to get involved?
Well, I was too busy settling my family, having left the army, and making money so that I could buy them a house to live in, and then fund them going through school and funding all the things that you need for families in modern United Kingdom, because unless you throw them on the mercy of the state schooling system. So I had to provide for my family first. And also, I set about creating businesses, doing good as I saw it, but employing people. And I think that outside of other things you do in life, giving people meaningful, well-paid occupations is a good thing. And in doing so, I paid tax. So I sat down and thought the other day, because I hear people saying that I shouldn't pass money on to my children because they haven't earned it. And I like the sound of that, except the thing is that if you follow that through in the logical extent, which socialists don't, then people on the dole won't get anything because they haven't earned it. And there's a lot of criticism of people who have created wealth. But what I'd say is that I served for 23 years in the army. And if you took my time in the Ulster Defence Regiment and Territorial Army, and then it was probably closer to about 27 years. And I looked at all the wages that had ever been paid in the army. And I looked at the education I received in Northern Ireland, which I got a grant and a maintenance grant, a free education university. I looked at what that cost. And then I looked at what I've paid in tax since I left the army. And I think I've repaid the nation more than 27 times. That's a good investment.
Last July in the general election, you did decide to stand for the Ulster Unionists in North Down, but you came third to an independent unionist, Alex Easton, and the Alliance Party's Stephen Farry. Why do you think you were unable to cut through in that particular election?
Well, I come from the North Down, and I looked at the voting patterns, and the general turnout is usually in the mid-50s or high 50s. So something like 42-44% of people in Northern Ireland don't vote. And the people who don't vote often are the people who are most vocal. It's the people who have got degrees, who are wealthy. It's the solicitors, it's the town planners, it's the people who, the dentists and the skin surgeons. They don't vote at all because they can't be bothered doing that. And then the lower classes in Northern Ireland who are totally unrepresented and probably some of the poorest people by per capita in the United Kingdom, they don't vote either. So what I was aiming for was to go to the people I'd gone to university and school with, who are at the top 20%, and persuade them to come out and vote, or shut up, I don't mind which, and to the lower 20% to say to them, look, there is hope. People can do stuff for you. And I focused a lot of time, most of my effort, on the working class and went to the working class estates in North Down. And Kilcooley Estate's one good example. I think there's 3,000 people there eligible to come out and vote. And I spent a lot of time talking to them at rallies, and people attended that, and everybody's nodding their head. On the night of the 3,000 people in Kilcooley alone who were able and registered to go and vote, 19 turned out.
There's a big problem with unionism at the minute, because they do recognise that, obviously, with reform sort of like breathing down their necks, possibly, they've got to come up with some big ideas, I guess.
Well, do they? I mean, does anybody in Northern Ireland? Mm. Northern Ireland can sit back and just enjoy it. The top the taxpayers, people like me, pay for it. They just have to sit and exist. They don't have to do anything. Mm. So politics really isn't, you know, and I've seen it at close hand. Politics isn't serious in the least bit in Northern Ireland. It's a rehash of the same old, same old. People forget that the Good Friday Agreement was, what, 27 years ago? Mm-hmm. And people are still banging on about it. And the standard of journalism in Northern Ireland is pretty ropey, frankly. And there isn't no sensible papers. You know, there's Belfast Telegraph used to be, but I call it the UDA News, because that's all it ever talks about is conspiracy theories about Robert Narak and Lord Lucan, or something to do with UDA. It's not a serious newspaper anymore.
Yeah. Would you consider becoming a Conservative candidate in 2029?
Not in the least, no. I think the Conservative Party has had its chips. I'm afraid it had a run at par. It made a complete mess of it, and I think it's lost the trust of the its traditional voters.
What about a reform candidate then, maybe?
No, I've no intention of becoming involved in politics at all, and I think that what we'll find is, again, politics in the United Kingdom have so lost their edge. And I think people have so low regard for it. One of the big problems we will have in the United Kingdom as a whole is people turning out to vote, because people have just lost faith in politicians. There is no incentive to be a politician. It's hard to get things done. And when you look at the political parties in the Southeast, we're threatened with wealth taxes here, which pretty much affects everybody. You know, if you live in a house, just an ordinary house that you have bought, say, in Canterbury, that, you know, Pilgrim's Way or something, those houses are probably nudging on to be worth £1 million. That's not your fault. That's just the market. If you put a 1% tax a year on that, those people are going to have to find £10,000 a year tax paid, which represents an income to earn extra about £15,000 a year just to stay in their house. And if your house is any bigger than that, it's bigger and bigger. Some people will be able to afford to stay in their houses. Some people won't. That's what the current government is suggesting is a wealth tax. They're saying that's fair. On the other hand, you see government ministers slithering and sliding to avoid paying any tax at all. And you see the Prime Minister accepting gifts of football tickets. It's seedy. Where is the integrity in politics anymore?
What do you think is the appeal of reform? And can they win, as the polls seem to suggest at the minute, that they can win a general election?
I think they can win a general election. I think people are completely disillusioned with a United Kingdom that's being run into the ground. There is no incentive to work or contribute to society. The 20% of the population in the United Kingdom is economically inactive. They will be Labour voters. The other 80% is broken down, but there's pretty much about 55% of the population that do work, do contribute, have property and have jobs, and they've had enough and they're looking for an alternative. And also we're seeing societies changed radically, and you're not allowed to say that because you're then called a racist. But the reality is that it's particularly with people overstaying work and student visas, that's the number of people turning up in boats is tiny in comparison. So last year, for instance, it was like 1 million people came into the country, of which about 300,000 or so left. So it's about 700,000 people here illegally. Tell me the difference between them or somebody who came on a boat. And remember, the people that came on the boat is 29,000. That's a tiny number against it. The thing is that because of the rules that were introduced, and sometimes just too excitedly, that things like family reunions, these aren't well thought through. Because what happens is with a family reunion is you get a family of six or a wife and a husband and six or seven children who can't speak English, and they get given a house through a family reunion. They're never not going to be reliant on the state. No, there's a fantasy that says that these people are there to contribute, pay tax. It's not impossible. What sort of job would you need to have to support seven children if you can't speak English? They're never not going to be dependent on the state, on the taxpayers, people like me, having to pay for that. And so I think people are kind of saying, look, we need to be sensible. We can't have an international health service. Our health, national health service is struggling for many reasons. It needs to be reformed. Mm-hmm. But that's one of the things that both political parties won't touch. Nobody's going to fix it until it's completely collapsed. And that's the wrong way to set about doing things. So there's a lot wrong with and even when we see the politicization of our police force, I mean, Graham Lennon being arrested for making a joke when there's our shopkeepers are being assaulted in their shops by violent shoplifters, and the police aren't even attending that. We've lost it. That's why reform will win the next election.
Do you see Nigel Farage as a prime minister in waiting?
Well, that's up to him, you know, and whether his party wants him to be that, because I think that Nigel Farage, he may have those ambitions. I don't know. I do know him to speak to, but I've never discussed the matter with him.
Kent County Council elected overwhelmingly a new Reform UK administration in May. Well, did that come as a shock to you?
No, not really, because the council wasn't functioning very well. I mean, council services, you know, I guess everyone listening will have their own story. I mean, the rigmarole I have to go, and I pay a lot of council tax to get my bins emptied. So normally what happens is on a Wednesday night, I put the bins out for Thursday. Then on Friday, my wife calls the Canterbury Council, and they arrange to have the bins cleared within the next week or so. You know, why can't we just have normal bin services?
Well, in fairness, Kent County Council don't collect the bins, but I know what you mean. There is a feeling out there that everything is broken.
Well, I mean, if you know, my son lives in Elam, and when you drive to Elam, the road as you get into Elam, which is on its way to the road, main road to Folkestone, it's a bus route, is slightly wider than my driveway. And it's full of potholes. And if you came from, say, Germany or Belgium, you're driving down that, you would think that you've taken a wrong turn. But no, that's the main road to Elam on your way to Folkestone.
All around the county, flags are hanging from lampposts, from motorway bridges and outside people's houses. Is this patriotism, or do you have a sense that it's really spurred on by the far right?
I think that the fantasy that the far right are sneaking about with Nazi armbands, telling people to go out and do things. The appearance of flags is a spontaneous thing. It's the reaction of working people to the circumstances they see around them. They're not far right. They're just the people that live here, and they're worried for their children. They're worried for their future, and they're expressing, because we've been told that the United Kingdom is a bad thing. Mm. Is there a possibility, for instance, that by displaying a Palestinian flag, you're actually supporting a violent terrorist organization? Or is that not count? Is it only a St. George's flag, for instance, that creates an effect? But Northern Ireland is a place where people fly flags, but that tends to be tribal, people marking territory. Mm. So there's no real comparison with that. I think this is a passing phase. It's a public show of dissatisfaction, and it's up to government to address the underlying issues or deal with that. Simply arresting people is not going to be a solution. Oppressing the native population is not going to be a solution. They have to address the core issues.
Thank you very much indeed for your time today, Tim Collins, and hope to speak to you again one day soon. The rise in the popularity of the Green Party across the country has certainly been reflected in Kent, where they now have a hand in running three councils, something that would have been unthinkable 10 years ago. And this week, the Greens chose Zach Plansky as its new leader. Dan and Matt are still with me. Dan, where do you see the direction of the Greens under Mr. Plansky, especially in the context of this new Labour movement spearheaded by Jeremy Corbyn?
So, yeah, the pitch Zach Polanski made for the leadership of the Green Party was basically the more unapologetically left-wing side of it compared to Adrian Ramsey and Ellie Chowns, who are also running, they posited a much more, at least aesthetically, moderate approach, whereas Zach Polansky calls himself an eco-populist. He's, you know, very firmly on the left. You know, in the past couple of days recently, he's you know, pretty openly speaks of being against immigration control, whether in whole or in part. Thinks that, you know, illegal immigration of small boats is not really a major issue, and wants to focus instead on climate and his preferred take on economic issues. So I think it's an indication of the fact that the activist base of the Green Party, the people who are voting in these elections, is significantly further to the left than probably the average member of the public, and of probably many of the Green Party's own supporters. Like you say, the Green Party runs quite a few local councils around the country, but the people who vote for them are not all, you know, young, you know, left-wing young professionals just out of university. A lot of them are older, more conservative, disaffected Tory voters. But what this also means by electing a new, you know, pretty explicitly left-wing leader is that they'll be in competition for largely the same electorate as what's currently called your party, soon, you know, to be democratically renamed at some point, which, you know, is currently led by Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana. And they'll be essentially competing for the same electorate. It'll be, you know, a mix of old left, sort of disaffected ex-Labour people, trade union alumni sorts, and young, disaffected left-wing professionals, more likely than not to be university graduates, who are very socially and culturally left-wing. So this means the big question for both your party and the Greens is, do they work together? Which, you know, if they did, I think they could probably get not a winning majority, but a decent percentage of the vote in some seats, and probably even take quite a few in London and the like. Or do they continue to stand against each other and not enter any agreement? And if they do that, I think that will further fracture what remains of a basically organised left-wing politics outside of the Labour Party in this country. And I think if they stand against each other, they'll just end up being the handmaidens of even more reform victories.
Matt, you know, is this going to benefit reform, do you think?
Oh, I would imagine so, Simon. It reminds me of that great quote about Margaret Thatcher, in that she was very lucky with her enemies. Yeah. I think Nigel Farage is looking at this and rubbing his hands. Dan makes a very valid point there, that it's only a very small part of the electorate that is that far left, that far interested in the sort of issues that Polansky is talking about. A vast majority of people in England are centre-right or occasionally centre-centre-left, you know. And I think that's where the vote is. That's where you win an election.
Dan, I mean, as a personality, Zach Polansky does actually have, you know, quite a lot, you know, attributes which will appeal to the young. I mean, he's a relatively young man. He's Jewish. He's gay. He's vegan. I mean, there's very much that's a kind of constituency that they're going to be trying to be tapping into.
Yeah, he seems like a relatively personable guy. I think those kind of identity matters aren't very frequently going into people's voting considerations, at least not for any large amount of the public. But yeah, I mean, he seems personally nice enough. Whether he has the kind of commanding public presence and authority that kind of politics needs to have any success, I think, is doubtful. You know, maybe I'm not too impressed because you have, for example, the current face of the American left, like Zoran Mamdani, the likely next mayor of New York, who's extremely charismatic and comes across quite well. I certainly don't think you could compare Zach Polansky's public image to someone like him. So I don't think force of personality will get him anywhere. Also, I'd like to add to something that Matt said. I don't think it's necessarily a case of the vast majority of the English public simply being, you know, conservative or centrist or whatever. I think the problem is that, much like Jeremy Corbyn's led Labour Party did, a lot of the individual policies that people on the relative left prefer, nationalisation of utilities, higher taxes on the wealthy, redistributive wealth, most of those things are very popular in isolation and most people agree with them. The problem is that the cultural and aesthetic package into which that is wrapped in the form of parties like your party and the Greens, which say immigration isn't a big deal, which are quite interested in issues of gender identity and that kind of thing. Those things, if not unpopular, they are seen as rather eccentric by the general public. And that is the problem that the modern left has had for a decade now.
Matt, finally, will they have to do a pact, the two of them, in order to make any headway, do you think?
I think it's a fair bet that they will, because there's only so many voters out there. And I think a deal will be there to be done. But the knock-on effects of what that might mean in terms of the Labour vote overall could be quite amazing. And I'd say, if I'm Nigel Farage, I'm rubbing my hands at this, because I think this opens the door a little bit more for me.
He refused, when he was interviewed the other night, Zach Polansky refused to sort of say anything until he knew what the party was called and what their constitution was. And I think, you know, if someone like George Galloway gets involved, he won't have anything to do with them, but we'll have to wait and see. That's your lot this week. Thanks to Dan and Matt for their contributions and to our special guest, Colonel Tim Collins. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage, and you can sign up for our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.